A Great Sacrifice, translated by Bhikkhu Sujato. Planes of consciousness. Mendicants, there are these seven planes of consciousness. What seven? There are sentient beings that are diverse in body and diverse in perception, such as human beings, some gods, and some beings in the underworld. This is the first plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that are diverse in body and unified in perception, such as the gods reborn in Brahma's host through the first absorption. This is the second plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that are unified in body and diverse in perception, such as the gods of streaming radiance. This is the third plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that are unified in body and unified in perception, such as the gods replete with glory. This is the fourth plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that have gone totally beyond perceptions of form. With the ending of perceptions of impingement, not focusing on perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, they have been reborn in the dimension of infinite space. This is the fifth plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that have gone totally beyond the dimension of infinite space. Aware that consciousness is infinite, they have been reborn in the dimension of infinite consciousness. This is the sixth plane of consciousness. There are sentient beings that have gone totally beyond the dimension of infinite consciousness. Aware that there is nothing at all, they have been reborn in the dimension of nothingness. This is the seventh plane of consciousness. These are the seven planes of consciousness. Prerequisites for immersion. Mendicants, there are these seven prerequisites for immersion. What seven? Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. Unification of mind with these seven factors as prerequisites is what is called noble right immersion, with its vital conditions and also with its prerequisites. Fires, first. Mendicants, there are these seven fires. What seven? The fires of greed, hate, delusion. The fires of those worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods, a householder's fire, the fire of those worthy of a religious donation, and a wood fire. These are the seven fires. Fires, second. Now at that time the Brahmin Ugata Sarira had prepared a large sacrifice. Bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats and rams, 500 of each, had been led to the post for the sacrifice. Then the Brahmin Ugata Sarira went up to the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversations were over, he sat down to one side and said to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, I have heard that kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post is very fruitful and beneficial." "I have also heard this, Brahmin." For a second time, and third time, Ugata Sarira said to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, I have heard that kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post is very fruitful and beneficial." "I have also heard this, Brahmin." "Then Master Gotama and I are in total agreement in this matter." When he said this, Venerable Ananda said to Ugata Sarira, "Brahmin, you shouldn't ask the Buddha in this way. You should ask in this way. Sir, I want to kindle the sacrificial fire and raise the sacrificial post. May the Buddha please advise and instruct me. It will be for my lasting welfare and happiness." Then Ugata Sarira said to the Buddha, "Sir, I want to kindle the sacrificial fire and raise the sacrificial post. May Master Gotama please advise and instruct me. It will be for my lasting welfare and happiness. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one raises three unskillful knives which ripen and result in suffering. What three? The knives of the body, speech, and mind. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one gives rise to the thought, may this many bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats, and rams be slaughtered for the sacrifice. Thinking, may I make goodness, one makes wickedness. Thinking, may I do good, one does bad. Thinking, may I seek the path to a good rebirth, one seeks the path to a bad rebirth. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one raises this first unskillful mental knife, which ripens and results in suffering. Furthermore, even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one says such things as, may this many bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats, and rams be slaughtered for the sacrifice. Thinking, may I make goodness, one makes wickedness. Thinking, may I do good, one does bad. Thinking, may I seek the path to a good rebirth, one seeks the path to a bad rebirth. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one raises this second unskillful verbal knife, which ripens and results in suffering. Furthermore, even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one first personally undertakes preparations for the sacrificial slaughter of bulls, bullocks, heifers, goats, and rams. Thinking, may I make goodness, one makes wickedness. Thinking, may I do good, one does bad. Thinking, may I seek the path to a good rebirth, one seeks the path to a bad rebirth. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one raises this third unskillful bodily knife, which ripens and results in suffering. Even before kindling the sacrificial fire and raising the sacrificial post, one raises these three unskillful knives, which ripen and result in suffering. Brahmin, these three fires should be given up and rejected, not cultivated. What three? The fires of greed, hate, and delusion. And why should the fire of greed be given up and rejected, not cultivated? A greedy person does bad things by way of body, speech, and mind. When their body breaks up after death, they're reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, hell. That's why the fire of greed should be given up and rejected, not cultivated. And why should the fire of hate be given up and rejected, not cultivated? A hateful person does bad things by way of body, speech, and mind. When their body breaks up after death, they're reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, hell. That's why the fire of hate should be given up and rejected, not cultivated. And why should the fire of delusion be given up and rejected, not cultivated? A deluded person does bad things by way of body, speech, and mind. When their body breaks up after death, they're reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, hell. That's why the fire of delusion should be given up and rejected, not cultivated. These three fires should be given up and rejected, not cultivated. Brahmin, you should properly and happily take care of three fires, honouring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating them. What three? The fire of those worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods, the fire of a householder, and the fire of those worthy of a religious donation. And what is the fire of those worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods? Your mother and father are called the fire of those worthy of offerings dedicated to the gods. Why is that? Since it is from them that you have been incubated and produced, so you should properly and happily take care of this fire, honouring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating it? And what is the fire of a householder? Your children, partners, bondservants, employees, and workers are called a householder's fire. So you should properly and happily take care of this fire, honouring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating it. And what is the fire of those worthy of a religious donation? The ascetics and Brahmins who avoid intoxication and negligence are settled in patience and gentleness, and who tame, calm, and extinguish themselves are called the fire of those worthy of a religious donation. So you should properly and happily take care of this fire, honouring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating it. You should properly and happily take care of these three fires, honouring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating them. But the wood fire, Brahmin, should from time to time be fanned, watched over with equanimity, extinguished or put aside. When he said this, the Brahmin Ukata Sarira said to the Buddha, "Excellent, Master Gotama, excellent. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. Master Gotama, I now set free these 500 bulls, 500 bullocks, 500 heifers, 500 goats, and 500 rams. I give them life. May they eat grass and drink cool water and enjoy a cool breeze." Perceptions in brief. Mendicants, these seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are very fruitful and beneficial. They culminate in the deathless and end with the deathless. What seven? The perceptions of ugliness, death, repulsiveness of food, dissatisfaction with the whole world, impermanence, suffering in impermanence, and not self in suffering. These seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are very fruitful and beneficial. They culminate in the deathless and end with the deathless. Perceptions in detail. Mendicants, these seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are very fruitful and beneficial. They culminate in the deathless and end with the deathless. What seven? The perceptions of ugliness, death, repulsiveness of food, dissatisfaction with the whole world, impermanence, suffering in impermanence, and not self in suffering. These seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are very fruitful and beneficial. They culminate in the deathless and end with the deathless. When the perception of ugliness is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of ugliness, their mind draws back from sexual intercourse. They shrink away, turn aside, and don't get drawn into it. And either equanimity or revulsion become stabilized. It's like a chicken's feather or a scrap of sinew thrown in a fire. It shrivels up, shrinks, rolls up, and doesn't stretch out. In the same way, when a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of ugliness, their mind draws back from sexual intercourse. They shrink away, turn aside, and don't get drawn into it. And either equanimity or revulsion become stabilized. If a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of ugliness, but their mind is drawn to sexual intercourse and not repulsed, they should know, "My perception of ugliness is undeveloped. I don't have any distinction higher than before. I haven't attained the fruit of development." In this way, they are aware of the situation. But if a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of ugliness, their mind draws back from sexual intercourse. They should know, "My perception of ugliness is well developed. I have realized a distinction higher than before. I have attained a fruit of development." In this way, they are aware of the situation. When the perception of ugliness is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of death is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of death, their mind draws back from desire to be reborn. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of the repulsiveness of food is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of the repulsiveness of food, their mind draws back from craving for tastes. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of dissatisfaction with the whole world is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of dissatisfaction with the whole world, their mind draws back from the world's shiny things. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of impermanence is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of impermanence, their mind draws back from material possessions, honours, and fame. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of suffering in impermanence is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of suffering in impermanence, they establish a keen perception of the danger of sloth, laziness, slackness, negligence, lack of commitment, and failure to review, just as towards a killer with a drawn sword. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. When the perception of not-self in suffering is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, but why did I say it? When a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of not-self in suffering, their mind is rid of ego, possessiveness, and conceit for this conscious body and all external stimuli. It has gone beyond discrimination and is peaceful and well freed. If a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of not-self in suffering, but their mind is not rid of ego, possessiveness, and conceit for this conscious body and all external stimuli, nor has it gone beyond discrimination and is not peaceful or well freed, they should know, my perception of not-self in suffering is undeveloped. I don't have any distinction higher than before. I haven't attained the fruit of development. In this way, they are aware of the situation. But if a mendicant often meditates with a mind reinforced with the perception of not-self in suffering, and their mind is rid of ego, possessiveness, and conceit for this conscious body and all external stimuli, and it has gone beyond discrimination, and is peaceful and well freed, they should know, my perception of not-self in suffering is well developed. I have realized a distinction higher than before. I have attained the fruit of development. In this way, they are aware of the situation. When the perception of not-self in suffering is developed and cultivated, it's very fruitful and beneficial. It culminates in the deathless and ends with the deathless. That's what I said, and this is why I said it. These seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are very fruitful and beneficial. They culminate in the deathless and end with the deathless. Sex, Then the Brahmin, Janusoni, went up to the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side and said to the Buddha, "Does Master Gotama claim to be celibate?" "Brahmin, if anyone should be rightly said to live the celibate life unbroken, impeccable, spotless and unmarred, full and pure, it's me. But what, Master Gotama, is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy? Firstly, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female. However, they consent to be anointed, massaged, bathed and rubbed by a female. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not freed from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. They're not freed from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing. However, they giggle and play and have fun with females. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They are not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. They are not free from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing, nor do they giggle and play and have fun with females. However, they gaze into a female's eyes. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing, nor do they giggle and play and have fun with females, nor do they gaze into a female's eyes. However, they listen through a wall or rampart to the sound of females laughing or chatting or singing or crying. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing, nor do they giggle and play and have fun with females, nor do they gaze into a female's eyes, nor do they listen through a wall or rampart to the sound of females laughing or chatting or singing or crying. However, they recall when they used to laugh, chat and have fun with females. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing, nor do they giggle and play and have fun with females, nor do they gaze into a female's eyes, nor do they listen through a wall or rampart to the sound of females laughing or chatting or singing or crying, nor do they recall when they used to laugh, chat and have fun with females. However, They see a householder or their child amusing themselves, supplied and provided with the five kinds of sensual stimulation. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. Furthermore, an ascetic or Brahmin who claims to be perfectly celibate does not mutually engage in sex with a female, nor do they consent to massage and bathing, nor do they giggle and play and have fun with females, nor do they gaze into a female's eyes, nor do they listen through a wall or rampart to the sound of females laughing or chatting or singing or crying, nor do they recall when they used to laugh, chat, and have fun with females, nor do they see a householder or their child amusing themselves, supplied and provided with the five kinds of sensual stimulation. However, they live the celibate life wishing to be reborn in one of the orders of gods. They think, by this precept or observance or fervent austerity or spiritual life, may I become one of the gods. They enjoy it and like it and find it satisfying. This is a break, taint, stain or mar in celibacy. This is called one who lives the celibate life impurely, yoked by the yoke of sex. They're not free from rebirth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. As long as I saw that these seven sexual yokes, or even one of them, had not been given up in me, I didn't announce my supreme perfect awakening in this world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans. But when I saw that these seven sexual yokes, every one of them, had been given up in me, I announced my supreme perfect awakening in this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans. Knowledge and vision arose in me. My freedom is unshakable. This is my last rebirth. Now there'll be no more future lives. When he said this, the Brahmin Janusoni said to the Buddha, "Excellent Master Gotama, excellent. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." Yoking and unyoking. Mendicants, I will teach you an exposition of the teaching on yoking and unyoking. Listen and apply your mind well. I will speak. And what is the exposition of the teaching on yoking and unyoking? A woman focuses on her own femininity, her feminine moves, feminine appearance, feminine ways, feminine desires, feminine voice, and feminine adornment. She's stimulated by this and takes pleasure in it. So she focuses on the masculinity of others, masculine moves, masculine appearance, masculine ways, masculine desires, masculine voice, and masculine adornment. She's stimulated by this and takes pleasure in it. So she desires to yoke herself to another, and she desires the pleasure and happiness that comes from such yoking. Sentient beings who relish their femininity are yoked to men. This is how a woman does not transcend her femininity. A man focuses on his own masculinity, his masculine moves, masculine appearance, masculine ways, masculine desires, masculine voice, and masculine adornment. He's stimulated by this and takes pleasure in it. So he focuses on the femininity of others, feminine moves, feminine appearance, feminine ways, feminine desires, feminine voice, and feminine adornment. He's stimulated by this and takes pleasure in it. So he desires to yoke himself to another, and he desires the pleasure and happiness that comes from such yoking. Sentient beings who relish their masculinity are yoked to women. This is how a man does not transcend his masculinity. This is how yoking comes about. And how does unyoking come about? A woman doesn't focus on her own femininity, her feminine moves, feminine appearance, feminine ways, feminine desires, feminine voice, and feminine adornment. She isn't stimulated by this and takes no pleasure in it. So she doesn't focus on the masculinity of others, masculine moves, masculine appearance, masculine ways, masculine desires, masculine voice, and masculine adornment. She isn't stimulated by this and takes no pleasure in it. So she doesn't desire to yoke herself to another. Nor does she desire the pleasure and happiness that comes from such yoking. Sentient beings who do not relish their femininity are not yoked to men. This is how a woman transcends her femininity. A man doesn't focus on his own masculinity, masculine moves, masculine appearance, masculine ways, masculine desires, masculine voice, and masculine adornment. He isn't stimulated by this and takes no pleasure in it. So he doesn't focus on the femininity of others, feminine moves, feminine appearance, feminine ways, feminine desires, feminine voice, and feminine adornment. He isn't stimulated by this and takes no pleasure in it. So he doesn't desire to yoke himself to another, nor does he desire the pleasure and happiness that comes from such yoking. Sentient beings who do not relish their masculinity are not yoked to women. This is how a man transcends his masculinity. This is how unyoking comes about. This is the exposition of the teaching on yoking and unyoking. A very fruitful gift. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Kampar on the banks of the Gagara lotus pond. Then several lay followers of Kampar went to Venerable Sariputta, bowed, sat down to one side and said to him, "Sir, it's been a long time since we've heard a Dhamma talk from the Buddha. It would be good if we got to hear a Dhamma talk from the Buddha." "Well then, reverence, come on the next Sabbath day. Hopefully you'll get to hear a Dhamma talk from the Buddha." "Yes, sir," they replied. Then they rose from their seats, bowed to Sariputta, and respectfully circled him before leaving. Then on the next Sabbath day, the lay followers of Kampar went to Venerable Sariputta, bowed and stood to one side. Then they went together with Sariputta to the Buddha, bowed and sat down to one side. Sariputta said to the Buddha, "Sir, could it be that someone gives a gift and it's not very fruitful or beneficial, while someone else gives exactly the same gift and it is very fruitful and beneficial?" "Indeed it could, Sariputta." "Sir, what is the cause? What is the reason for this?" "Sariputta, take the case of someone who gives a gift as an investment, their mind tied to it, expecting to keep it, thinking, 'I'll enjoy this in my next life.' They give to ascetics or Brahmins such things as food, drink, clothing, vehicles, garlands, fragrance and makeup, and bed, house and lighting. What do you think, Sariputta? Don't some people give gifts in this way?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sariputta, someone who gives a gift as an investment, when their body breaks up after death, is reborn in the company of the gods of the four great kings. When that deed, success, fame and sovereignty is spent, they return to this state of existence." "Next, take the case of someone who gives a gift not as an investment, their mind not tied to it, not expecting to keep it, and not thinking, 'I'll enjoy this in my next life.' But they give a gift thinking, 'It's good to give.' They give a gift thinking, 'Giving was practiced by my father and my father's father. It would not be right for me to abandon this family tradition.' They give a gift thinking, 'I cook, they don't. It wouldn't be right for me not to give to them.' They give a gift thinking, 'The ancient Brahmin seers were Ataka, Vamaka, Vamadeva, Visvamitra, Yamadagi, Angirasa, Bharadwaja, Vasita, Kasapa, and Bhagu. Just as they performed great sacrifices, I will share a gift. They give a gift thinking, when giving this gift, my mind becomes clear and I become happy and joyful. They don't give a gift thinking, when giving this gift, my mind becomes clear and I become happy and joyful. But they give a gift thinking, this is an adornment and requisite for the mind. They give to ascetics or Brahmins such things as food, drink, clothing, vehicles, garlands, fragrance and makeup, and bed, house and lighting. What do you think, Sariputta? Don't some people give gifts in this way? Yes, sir. Sariputta, someone who gives gifts not for any other reason but thinking this is an adornment and requisite for the mind, when their body breaks up after death, is reborn among the gods of Brahma's host. When that deed, success, fame, and sovereignty is spent, they are a non-returner. They do not return to this state of existence. This is the cause, this is the reason why someone gives a gift, and it's not very fruitful or beneficial, while someone else gives exactly the same gift, and it is very fruitful and beneficial. Nanda's mother. So I have heard. At one time the venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana were wandering in the southern hills together with a large sangha of mendicants. Now at that time the laywoman Welukantaki, Nanda's mother, rose at the crack of dawn and recited the verses of The Way to the Far Shore. And at that time the great king Wesawana was on his way from the north to the south on some business. He heard Nanda's mother reciting and stood waiting for her to finish. Then, when her recital was over, she fell silent. Then, knowing she had finished, Wesawana applauded, saying, "Good sister, good sister." "But who might you be, my dear?" "Sister, I am your brother, Wesawana, the great king." "Good, my dear. Then may my recital of the teaching be my offering to you as my guest." "Good, sister, and let this also be your offering to me as your guest. Tomorrow, the mendicant sangha, headed by Sariputta and Moggallana, will arrive at Welukanta before breakfast. When you've served the sangha, please dedicate the religious donation to me. Then that will also be your offering to me as your guest." And when the night had passed, the laywoman, Nanda's mother, had delicious fresh and cooked foods prepared in her own home. Then the sangha of mendicants, headed by Sariputta and Moggallana, arrived at Welukanta. Then Nanda's mother addressed a man, "Please, mister, go to the monastery and announce the time to the sangha, saying, 'Sirs, it's time. The meal is ready in the home of the lady Nanda's mother.'" "Yes, ma'am," that man replied, and he did as she said. And then the sangha of mendicants, headed by Sariputta and Moggallana, robed up in the morning, and, taking their bowls and robes, went to the home of Nanda's mother, where they sat on the seats spread out. Then Nanda's mother served and satisfied them with her own hands, with delicious fresh and cooked foods. When Sariputta had eaten and washed his hand and bowl, Nanda's mother sat down to one side. Sariputta said to her, "Nanda's mother, who told you that the sangha of mendicants was about to arrive?" "Sir, last night I rose at the crack of dawn and recited the verses of The Way to the Far Shore, and then I fell silent. Then the great king Wesawana, knowing I had finished, applauded me. 'Good sister, good sister.' I asked, 'But who might you be, my dear?' 'Sister, I am your brother Wesawana, the great king.' 'Good, my dear. Then may my recital of the teaching be my offering to you as my guest.' 'Good, sister, and let this also be your offering to me as your guest. Tomorrow the mendicant sangha, headed by Sariputta and Moggallana, will arrive at Welukanta before breakfast. When you've served the sangha, please dedicate the religious donation to me. Then that will also be your offering to me as your guest." And so, sir, may the merit and the flourishing of merit of this gift be for the happiness of the great King Wesawana. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing that you converse face to face with a mighty and illustrious god like the great King Wesawana. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. I had an only son called Nanda, who I loved dearly. The rulers forcibly abducted him on some pretext and had him executed. But I can't recall getting upset when my boy was under arrest, or being arrested, imprisoned, or being put in prison, killed, or being killed. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing that you purify even the arising of a thought. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. When my husband passed away, he was reborn in one of the realms of spirits. He revealed to me his previous life form, but I can't recall getting upset on that account. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing that you purify even the arising of a thought. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. Ever since we were both young, and I was given in marriage to my husband, I can't recall betraying him even in thought, still less in deed. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing that you purify even the arising of a thought. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. Ever since I declared myself a lay follower, I can't recall deliberately breaking any precept. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. Whenever I want, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, I enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. As the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are stilled, I enter and remain in the second absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of immersion, with internal clarity and mind at one, without placing the mind and keeping it connected. And with the fading away of rapture, I enter and remain in the third absorption, where I meditate with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss. With the giving up of pleasure and pain, and the ending of former happiness and sadness, I enter and remain in the fourth absorption, without pleasure or pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing. Sir, this is not my only incredible and amazing quality. There is another. Of the five lower fetters taught by the Buddha, I don't see any that I haven't given up. It's incredible, Nanda's mother. It's amazing. Then Venerable Sariputta educated, encouraged, fired up, and inspired Nanda's mother with a Dhamma talk, after which he got up from his seat and left.